me welcome everyone who's here tonight. We do have visitors. We're glad you're here. Labor Day weekend, about half our folks are gone, but we're glad you're here filling out the building. And welcome you to come back at every opportunity you have. We'd love to have you again in the future. I do want to make a couple of announcements. One that I meant to make this morning, and I apologize. You may have noticed there's a really snazzy new safety lock, or whatever you call it, on the side door. If you haven't noticed that, take a look at it. Kevin spent the better part of yesterday evening putting that in. So make sure you tell him he's wonderful and great and all of that stuff, and give him appreciation. But no, we appreciate people lending their talents. I know Ed does a lot of work around here and keeps things going. We really appreciate that. Another good announcement. It's been a day for that. We had a baptism, of course, this morning, as was announced. And then I ended up doing a wedding this afternoon. So Dwayne and Dinah were married over in our front yard this morning. So that's fantastic. So anyway, been a good day. And oddly enough, I had planned to preach a sermon tonight called Complain, Complain. And I don't feel much like complaining this evening. But I want us to look at this. This is going to be an easy lesson to follow along. I'm going to start with a passage in the New Testament. Then I'm going to go to the Old Testament. I'm going to stay there all but the last 5 minutes or less even of the sermon. So you will easily be able to follow along in the book of Exodus. But before I get back there, I'm going to look at Matthew 20. And you may remember this is a parable that Jesus told. It is a fairly well-known parable in which a number of people hire out, so to speak, to a householder, as he's called. But if you will note with me in this story, you may remember it because in verse 2, he goes out and he hires, or verse 1, he hires laborers for his vineyard. Verse 2, they agreed for a day's wage. They're going to go out and work about 12 hours. And the Bible goes on to say, verse 3, that about the third hour, which would be about 9 o'clock in the morning, he saw some others standing. They weren't doing anything and hired them as well. Go work in my vineyard. They did. Went out about noon. There were still other people. He hired them. They also went out, started working in his vineyard. And even up to, if you'll notice verse 6, the 11th hour, which would be roughly about 5 o'clock in the evening or afternoon, he hired them to work for the final hour. If you remember the point of this story, though, when it comes to the end of the day, those that started at 6 that morning all the way up to those that didn't start until 5 p.m., he paid them all equally a full day's wage. Naturally, then, that led to some complaining on the part of the people, especially if you'll notice verse 10, when the first group, the 6 o'clockers in the morning, when they came and supposed that they would receive considerable more money for working than those that came surely as late as 5 p.m., but everybody received the same amount. Notice verse 11, they murmured or complained, grumbled against the owner of the house and the vineyard because they ought to be paid more. Now, that's a typical story. It is the typical nature of human beings to complain, especially when they perceive things as being unfair, unjust, I'm not being treated the way I should, etc., etc. What I find interesting about this story is if you look at verse 1 and not miss this point, Jesus said, for the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven, when he introduces this story, he's talking about the church. And he's doing teaching about the church. And so if you notice the point here, it's not just that everybody in the world grumbles, complains, murmurs, etc., but Christians do too. And so the idea here is that even Christians are like this. We all seem to be naturally disposed to grumble or complain about things, and God would have us to do otherwise. So I think as you begin to consider the nature of complaining, maybe there are some conclusions, maybe there are a lot of conclusions you can draw about it, but I want to introduce it by saying that complaining is generally accompanied by some similarities, some consistencies, if you will. One of them is a lack of faith. One of the reasons I complain is because I do maybe look at my situation, I consider my circumstances, but I don't consider those as God would view them. That was some of what we were talking about this morning. This sermon goes hand in hand with that. I need to take a view that God knows what is best. If I'm a Job and all of a sudden things are happening to me and I really don't think they ought to be happening, I need to step back for a moment, have some faith that maybe I don't know, but God does. It's generally a lack of faith, and it's faith especially in God to accomplish what God knows is good for us through whatever set of circumstances. And so my first disposition as a Christian ought to be, I trust God, God will work it out, rather than, this ain't right. And so I begin to complain. But consistently, when people complain, there is a lack of faith. There is also an immaturity about that. Children naturally complain. They don't know any better than to complain when anything is not right. I mean, when we start as infants and we're hungry, we cry. That's our way of complaining. We cry, sometimes we scream. If I'm wet, if I'm this, if I'm that, I don't know anything else. But we are expected by God to mature and to have a more mature attitude about life and thus a different outlook on life. And that takes maturity. It takes growing up. And generally speaking, a complainer, at least a habitual one, is one who lacks maturity. And I would say this finally, there's a third thing, and maybe there are many others, but the third thing that I'd like to emphasize tonight is, not only is there a lack of faith, and not only is there an immaturity, but there's also a lack of gratitude. Because what I'm thinking about first is what I ain't got right now, is the point. I don't have this right now, and I want it. And I'm not focusing on what I have, and everything else I have. You know, when we talk to people that are married, and especially doing some counseling and all of that kind of thing, and married people, this is one of the greatest things that causes problems. Obviously, recognizing something in the other that you don't like or you think is unfair or whatever it might be, and you begin to complain about that, and that grows into a real problem. And one of the things that you want to stress is, rather than what you don't have, because nobody's perfect, if you're looking for the individual who's going to be perfect, that's going to give everything perfectly, do everything perfectly, then good luck, because none of us are perfect. But rather than looking at all of that, look at the things you have. Not just complain about what you don't have, but what do you have? What is special about this person? Why did you marry them in the first place? All of that kind of thing. It's not a lesson about marriage, but it is about gratitude. And so here I am, a Christian, and I've got a choice. Do I thank God for what I have? Sometimes I believe if there were more thanksgiving in our prayers, there would be less complaining in our life. Do I thank God for what I have, or is it generally that I just take note of what I don't have and I complain? The Christian has to learn to take a longer view of things. Not just right now, at this moment, what I want, instant gratification, but a longer view of things. And take notice of the circumstances. And view them in with respect to the wisdom that God has and the control that God has. Now, I want us to go back to this passage in Numbers. And let's look at Numbers chapter 14. And I'm going to take notice of the end of the story first, and then we're going to kind of look at the story. So I want us to picture, and I'm sure we're all familiar here tonight, with the story of the Israelites and the exodus out of Egypt and all of that. They were coming, they were headed for the promised land. The land had been promised all the way back to their ancestor Abraham, reiterated to Isaac, again to Jacob, and no doubt it had been told down through the generations, down through the 400 plus years. They had eagerly anticipated a deliverer who would bring them into the promised land, and now they are actually on the way. But it takes them about 2 years to get to the brink of the promised land, and when they get to it in Numbers, God has some individuals, one from each tribe, He has them chosen and sent in to spy, if you will, out the land, because they're commonly known as the 12 spies. But to do some reconnaissance, to look at the land, to see what it had to offer, come back with a report. And you know that when they came back with the report, saving for Joshua and Caleb, who urged, hey, let's go in and get what's ours. The rest of them were like, no way, we can't do it, etc., etc. And God, down in verse 22, has had enough. And we're going to look at why in just a moment. Because it will do us good to maybe see ourselves in these people. But in Numbers 14 and verse 22, God has had enough, and he said, because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles, which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have tempted or tested or tried me now these 10 times, and have not hearkened to my voice. And what he goes on to say is, because they've done that, I've had it, you're not going into the land. Nobody, except for Joshua and Caleb, over the age of 20, is going in. God had had enough. And God makes the point here 10 times. Now, I will tell you up front, before I go back into Exodus, that there is some debate about this in verse 22. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on numerology, but some people see this as a literal 10 times. And it may be, because oddly enough, you can actually go back and count up 10 specific great times of griping and complaining. And we're going to do that. But others see 10 as the number of completion, like you might see the church at Smyrna, for example. Smyrna, I think, Sardis, one of the two. In Revelation 2, I kind of lost it there. But the church in Revelation 2, be faithful unto death, but you're going to have persecution or tribulation for 10 days. Not a literal 10 days there, but it is rather a complete, short amount of time, but a complete amount nonetheless. And it might be that. There may have been a whole lot of other incidents. There may be even other incidents in the chapters that we're going to look at. But I decided to choose out at least these, and they possibly add up to the exact amount of times and the exact instances that God is looking at. And if these incidents are the ones God is referring to, then you can understand why he's had enough by this point in Numbers 14. Let's go back to Exodus 12. When we go back to Exodus 12, if you remember, and I want you just to kind of keep a story running in your mind. Picture it however it is you picture it. But you are the Israelites. Your grandfathers, your great-grandfathers, everybody in anybody's memory and way beyond that have been slaves in Egypt. You've been crying out to God. By God's own admission, it's been grievous cries. You've been begging and crying and pleading with God to send somebody to deliver you out of the hands of the Egyptians. You can't stand it. You can't bear it. You can't take it anymore. You want out of Egypt. And God sends Moses. And Moses takes with him Aaron, and they go before the Pharaoh, and God exercises his power, demonstrates that he is God, and a series of plagues proves that. The Nile turns to blood, the frog, the lice, the boils. All of that comes even down to Exodus 12, the death of the firstborn. The crying, the wailing, there must have been all over Egypt when all of these people died, when everybody lost their firstborn. God showing, I have the power. Let my people go. You've taken the Passover. You've thought about all of that. You've witnessed that God is a powerful God. You can put some blood on the doorpost and your child doesn't die, but everybody else's does. Man, the power of God. And they come out of Egypt and they come with tribute, with all of that back payment if you want to look at it, some do. But they come out of Egypt with riches and goods and hope, and they're on the way to the promised land, and everything is going to be wonderful if you notice. And as they come out, you look at verse 29, it was midnight when the Lord smote all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on his throne under the firstborn of the captive that was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn, even of the animals. They all died. And God demonstrates his power. Chapter 13, they are on their way. What a massive sight that must have been. It is estimated that over 2 million Israelites came out of Egypt. At one point, Moses will make the point to God, there are 600,000 footmen. That's able-bodied men who could fight in a battle. So there had to be somewhere over 2 million people on a march with all these animals and all these goods and all this jubilee going on of being delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And as they're on their way, if you look at chapter 13 and you're just following along with me, look down at verse 20. The Bible says they took their journey from Succoth and encamped in Etham. at the edge of the wilderness, and the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of a cloud to lead them by the day, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light. He went by day and night. He took not away the pillar of fire by day, rather the cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night. He went before the people and reminding them 24 hours a day. You could wake up at any time in the day, look up at any time of the day. God is with us. Must have been magnificent. You would love to be back there and see that. Chapter 14, they are still on their way. And in chapter 14, if you'll look down in verse 10, Pharaoh has decided, no, I'm going to get them. I'm chasing them. And so the Bible talks about, as Ed read for us, Pharaoh drew nigh. The people noticed Pharaoh, took note of Pharaoh. And if you look at the story, I'm not going to look at it that closely, but they were literally backed into a corner. It was almost as though God has strategically placed them in a hole, if you will, by the Red Sea. There were rock, mountains of rocks to the right, mountains of rocks to the left, the sea to their back, and Pharaoh was breathing down their neck, coming straight at them. And they began to cry out. And what they say is, notice verse 11, because there were no graves in Egypt, you took us out here to die in the wilderness. How incredible is that? You've seen the power of God. You've seen what God can do. And now immediately you're going to look at this, you're not thinking. You're not thankful to God for what He's done. You're not being mature about this. You're not thinking about what you have, what God can do. You're not applying any of that. You're just looking at it and you're scared and you're reacting. And that's what we do when we complain. They don't even stop to think. You just brought us out here to die. It's ridiculous. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. God, of course, parted the Red Sea, defeated utterly Pharaoh and his army. They marched across on dry land. I often think about, do you know what the number one complaint was in the wilderness? You ever stop to count and to add what they complained about the most? They got thirsty. And I find it interesting that God chose the first test, the first gripe, the first complaint, the very first one, to be about water. And God showed His power. If I've got power to part the Red Sea, you guys not think I've got power to give you something to drink? But they didn't think. Go with me, if you will, turn a page over to chapter 15. And notice they've crossed the Red Sea. And now they're continuing on their way. And if you'll drop down with me into verse 23. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah because they were bitter. And so they called the name of the place Marah, which naturally means bitter. But the water was too bitter. They couldn't drink it. So they complained against Moses. And they said, what shall we drink? And he cried to the Lord, and of course the Lord showed him a tree. Throw the tree in, the water becomes sweet, you can drink it. They're still complaining. We don't have anything to drink. Forget all that, that you just divided the Red Sea. We're thirsty. We got nothing to drink. How immature, how like a child is that? That's not like a mature individual of faith. That's not coming to a situation and saying, hey, we have to have water. We have to have it. God knows we have to have it. What's God going to do? We know He's going to do something. Let's just have faith that God will take care of it. You pray to God, you trust God, you let it go at that. But they didn't do that. What are we going to drink? We're thirsty. It's like the little child, I'm thirsty. Okay, when we get down the road, we're at a place where we get some water, we'll get some water. But I can't just magically make water appear. No telling how many times I was told that as a child, but that's a different story. But the idea of being so immature, I want water, I want it now. They complained. And of course, God provided the sweet water to drink. Look at chapter 16, if you will. Start with me in verse 1. They took their journey from Elim. And all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. On the 15th day of the second month after the departing out of the land of Egypt, and the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured or complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The children of Israel said unto, would to God Notice how their complaints are intensifying. I'll tell you something about complaining. It's amazing. You see it in children. You see it in adults. We start out with a kind of a gentle complaint, a mild complaint. We test. As children, we test, we complain, and we see how much is that going to annoy dad or mom. If it doesn't annoy too bad, well, I'll keep it up until they get annoyed. We learn, we test them, we push them. And as adults, we do the same thing, only we do it with God. Notice how their complaint is intensifying. Not just, what are we going to drink? Not just, weren't there enough graves in Egypt? But now it is, we wish to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. Have you ever stopped to think about that statement? I wish to God that I had died by His hand. You know, if you're God and you are human and you think like I do, I'd be thinking, dude, I can still make that possible. What a bold statement. Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the flesh pots, when we did eat bread to the full. But you brought us out here into this wilderness to kill a whole bunch of us in hunger. That's incredible. Seems to me like one of the last things Pharaoh did was to say, work hard all day, find your own straw, and find your own food. Would to God we died when we were in Egypt and everything was so wonderful. Now this is where in verse 4, if you'll notice, the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread, manna. I'll rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day that I may prove them, test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. Notice what God is saying here. God is giving them bread. God is going to provide. But now God is going to test them as He provides. I think it's a great lesson there for parents. Again, this is not a lesson about parenting. But you notice what God is doing here. I'm going to give them what they need. Even though it's come about because they've not trusted me, they've not had faith, they've complained, but I'm still going to give them what they need because they're my children. But I'm not just going to give it to them and that just be it. As though every time in life you can just complain and get everything you want. No, I'm going to start testing them. I'm going to give them rules with the provision. And I'm going to test them to see whether or not they'll follow the rules or not. And so the Bible talks about He rained bread upon them. Notice down in verses, I think it's 19 and 20. I hope I wrote the right verses down. Moses said, let no man leave of it till the morning. And notwithstanding verse 20, they don't follow the rules. They're obstinate children. They're not going to obey God. No, they didn't listen unto Moses. Some of them left it until the morning, and it bred worms, and it stank, and Moses was wroth with them. That's what they're going to be like. I want what I want. I don't care about any rules, and I don't respect anything. I'm just going to do what I want to do. The kingdom of heaven is likened unto. You ever know members of the church were that way? They conducted their lives that way? But we go on. Look at chapter 17. In chapter 17 and verse 1, all the congregation of the children of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin after their journeys according to the commandment of the Lord, and they pitched in Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Is this starting to sound like a, you know? Yeah, no water for the people to drink. So the people did chide with Moses. Now that's a little stronger term. To chide with someone means you complain, but you're mean about it. This is when you start getting angry with somebody. And this is when you start saying the things you should not be saying. The Lord does not chide with us. That's not the way He treats us, the psalmist says. But the people chided with Moses. And the Bible goes on to say here, the people did chide with Moses, and they said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, why do you chide with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for the water. And so the people complained against Moses and said, why is this that you brought us up out of Egypt to kill us, to kill our children and our animals even with thirst? This is mean-spirited. This is really getting after him. And Moses cried to the Lord and said, what do I do with this people? They're ready to stone me. That's how angry they were. That's how mean-spirited they were. And if you'll notice, they go on to call the place. He goes on to name this place here in verses 5 through 7. And let's just note that. The Lord said to Moses, go on and go on before the people and take with thee of the elders of Israel and your rod wherewith you smote the river. Take it in your hand, and I will stand before you upon the rock in Horeb, and hit the rock, smite the rock. And there shall come water out of it for the people to drink. And Moses did that in the sight of the elders of Israel. And then he called the name of that place Massah and Meribah. You know what those names mean, and maybe your Bible tells you that in a footnote. It means temptation and chiding. It's as if to say to these people, God has miraculously provided you water, but let's not forget what happened here. Let's not forget how mean you were about it. Let's not forget what you said. Because, you know, you have to live with what you say. And sometimes things that people say when they're complaining are the things that remain for the rest of their lives. And sometimes between two people, when complaining is going on, you know, when you sit down and talk to married people who are really, really having trouble, a lot of times it comes down to not what they did, but what they said in their anger, how they reacted to each other, how they didn't try to work together, how they were never thankful, how they were immature, and all of those things came pouring out. And you know, I could live with a lot of things, but when he said this, or she said that, Moses said, let's not forget. Every time in your lives, when you think about this place or bring your kids here, you look at these rocks, remember what their names are. Because that's you. And that's what you said. I wonder sometimes in the 40 years how many times they circled around and passed by those rocks and remembered the way they were. Time and time and time again, every time God gives them the water, every time God gives them what they need, and they never shut up. And they get worse. Let's go on. Chapter 20. And chapter 20 is kind of a strange passage, but this is where God is going to give the commandments. And of course, it will start off with sort of the Bill of Rights and the Mosaic Covenant, and that's the Ten Commandments. And he'll go on for chapters here, giving laws and, you know, various stipulations, etc. Almost like clauses to some of those laws. But starting here in chapter 20, if you will notice, the Bible talks about the people and how they drew near to God. And I want you to look down at verse 18. The people saw the thunderings and the lightnings. You know, you would love to see this. To see the power of God. To be in the presence of God. How many of you have thought about what it must be like? And wondered at that. And wished just for once in life you could actually see something like this. Well, they were there. But they were too immature to handle it. They saw the thunderings, heard them, the lightnings, the noise of the trumpet, the mountains smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. They didn't want to get close. And they said unto Moses, speak thou with us, and we will hear, but don't let God speak with us. We don't want to hear God, lest we die. Now, to me personally, I find that very prophetic. I know it's not what they meant in one sense, but it's what they said. We don't want to hear God. We'll let you speak for God, but we don't want to hear God himself. How like people is that? And so Moses said to the people, don't fear. God is come to test you, to prove you. And that his fear may be before your faces, that you sin not. But the people stood afar off, and so Moses drew near into the thick darkness where God was. We don't want to be in the presence of God. And they complained about it. You brought us here and you want us to go to this? You know, we didn't think God would be like this. How like people is that? Well, God does go on, though, and give the law to Moses. Obviously, chapters pass here. And then go over with me, if you will, after. And this goes on for several chapters. But go with me to chapter 32. There's a very famous story in our incident in this whole story. And this is, of course, where Moses is separated from them, and they begin to cry out to Aaron. They saw that Moses delayed, verse 1, in his coming. He hadn't come down from the mountain. They gathered themselves together to Aaron, and they said, "Up, make us gods. Make us a false god, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not." We don't know what has become of him. Isn't that incredible? Is that not absolutely incredible? God has been with Moses, demonstrating his power. Every time Moses has stood and spoken, God has demonstrated his power through Moses, and you don't know where Moses is and what God has done with him. Do you ever stop to think for one second that maybe God can handle this deal? How like little children that is. How like me that's been so many times in my life. You step back and you look at this and you can get down on these people and you could say, have I ever been like this? Have I ever wondered at what in the world is going on? What is God doing? Rather than saying to myself, God knows what He's doing. Let God handle it. Let God take care of it. Quit complaining. Just stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. But they complained. And you know the story here. Moses was up there. Aaron made the golden calf. All of that goes on. Horrible incident. I'm sure you're familiar with the story. I'm not going to spend very much time on it. Remember, Moses does come back down. 3,000 people die in that incident. It's a very horrible time. And beyond that, the Lord plagues the people. I don't know what it was exactly, but God sent some plague, some disease among them to remind them of what they had done. And that should have been an incident where they really took stock of their lives. And you know, that happens with people sometimes. Sometimes you complain. You hit a wall. You hit some big incident in your life. You go too far, and you know it. And you suffer the consequences. And you take a step back, and that's where you begin to grow up. You get some maturity. You gain some faith. You start looking at things the way God would have you look at them. And you begin to thank God for not abandoning you like He did not with these people. They're still my people. And I won't abandon them. They're still my children. And you thank God for being there for you. In the worst time in your life, when you left God, He still didn't leave you. And so you grow up. And you turn to God. But they didn't. So the laws continue to be given. And I want you to go over with me to the book of Leviticus now as we're coming to the end of the story. And we'll pick up the story. I said Leviticus. And Numbers. The book of Numbers. So we turn over to Numbers chapter 11. We go all the way through Leviticus with all those laws. But we get to Numbers and we're coming to the end of the story. Now the Bible tells us, if you look at verse 1 in the very first part of the verse, the people complain. They haven't learned anything. They haven't grown up. They're still complaining. And it displeased the Lord. Now God is getting tired of it. And you know that happens. I mean, you can go just so far with people. We are made in the image of God. God is not different from us in that respect. We are not different from Him. And when a person just goes on and on and on and refuses to yield, then you start getting tired of it. God is tired of it. The people complain. This time they complain because they're hungry. And so the Bible shows us in this story, if you'll continue reading right here with me, the Lord was displeased and He heard it and His anger was kindled. And the fire of the Lord burnt among them and consumed them that were in the outermost parts of the camp. And the people cried unto Moses. And when Moses prayed to the Lord, the fire was quenched. And he called the name of the place Taberah. Because the fire of the Lord burnt, the burning, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. And the mixed multitude that was among them fell a-lusting. They don't learn anything. Now they're piling complaint upon complaint. Even when God severely punishes, they just continue right on with what they were doing. They fell a-lusting. And the children of Israel wept again. And they said, "Who shall give us flesh to eat?" We remember them in meat. God's been raining down all of this manna. Well, that's not good enough anymore. Hey, we had an abundance of meat back in Egypt. We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt freely. You remember the fact that you had to go out and fish for it or starve? But no, we remember the fish. We had abundant amount of fish in Egypt. We had cucumbers and melons and leeks and onions and garlic. We had everything we wanted. But now our soul is dried away. And there's nothing at all besides this manna. And you can almost see him saying it like that. I remember being a little kid, and I was talking in class this morning about it. We were very, very poor when I was really young. And we went through a couple of years where Mom and Dad were having to pay off a whole lot of bills. And there was just me. And I can remember the three of us, and I was just a little fellow, but I can remember the three of us, and every night we sat down to dinner, and it was the same dinner. We had dried beans, no meat. We had dried beans. Either we had dried pinto beans, dried Great Northern beans, or some kind of dried bean, and we had potatoes. They were either creamed potatoes, mashed potatoes, fried potatoes, baked potatoes, boiled potatoes, but they had potatoes. Because you could buy a big sack of potatoes and a big bag of beans for cheap. And a luxury was what was whenever Dad, in between two or three jobs that he might be working, got enough time to go to the river and fish and catch some fish. And then I had to beg and plead and complain to be able to eat some of the fish because they were scared I'd swallow a bone. That was rough times, baby. Complain. And then I got older. And then it was on me that if I didn't go out and find some work today, I don't eat. And I thought sometimes during those times, lean times, potted meat times. You ever ate pie? I will never again in my life, I hope, eat potted meat. Potted meat times. And I remembered, man, I wish I had some of those beans and potatoes, you know? Good stuff, boy. All we got is a stinking manna. God said, all right, I'll send you quail. Moses said, God, wait a minute, God. How many people are out here? You know how much food it would take to feed all these people? How many animals got to die? God said, Moses, I'm God. Believe I can handle it. God brought all these quail from the sea. No idea where they came from. We don't need to know. And God said, you're going to eat, and you're going to eat till you puke it. So you remember all this complaining. But they don't. In chapter 10, or verse 10 rather, of Numbers 11, we even see Moses getting in on it. You know, complaining is contagious. When people complain all around you and you're trying to stay positive and you're trying to be upbeat and you're trying to, you know, things are good, things are fine, God will work things out, and everybody is complaining, it beats you down. And Moses got caught up in it. And so did his sister, and so did his brother. Complaining is contagious. And so in chapter 12, if you'll notice in verse 1, even Miriam and Aaron. This is where, of course, God strikes Miriam and she becomes a leper. Complain, complain, complain. I want you to go with me to chapter 13, though, as we close this out. The Lord spoke to Moses, and he said, send men that they may search the land of Canaan, that I give to the children of Israel. Now, I want you to hear that. I'm not going to read this whole two chapters here. We don't have time, and I know you know the story. But notice what he says from the very beginning. Regardless of all the complaining, I give you this beautiful land. Send 12 guys in. Well, they chose the 12 guys. And they went and they looked, and if you'll notice, I just want to read verse 23, I think it is. They came to the brook of Eshcol. They cut down from there a branch with one cluster of grapes. And they bare it between the two of them upon a staff. And they brought of the pomegranates and of the figs. I have actually seen a picture in which in perfect conditions, perfect climate, the right species of grapes, and they're literally about that big, about as big as a tennis ball, one grape. And you can take a cluster of grapes, and this is not even an exaggeration. It is so big, you will have to put it on a pole to be carried between two men. This is how rich this land was. That's why it was called the pleasant land. That's why it's called the fertile Crescent. It's rich. And they went there and they saw it. But you know what else they saw? It had a lot of people there. It was inhabited by different nations of people. And some of them were even giants. And they felt themselves to be as grasshoppers, if you'll notice the end of the chapter, the last verse. We're just grasshoppers in their sight. We can't do this. And so they came back. And even though Joshua and Caleb urged them, go in. God says we can take it. God says He gave it to us. It's ours. No, we can't do it. And they fought against Joshua and Caleb. They convinced the people. The people began to complain to Moses, don't take us in there to die. And the more they complained, the more God listened to that. And finally God said, that's it! That's it! You don't go! You stay out here and you die! And I'll give it to your children. And you know, there's a lesson there. We go to the New Testament. And we look at the Bible relating this story in 1 Corinthians 10. Warning us. We look at Philippians 2. Don't grumble. Don't murmur. Don't complain. Believe in God. Let God perform in you what He wills to perform. Trust Him. Or else God may look at you and say, enough! You die. And you die wherever you are, in whatever you're in, and you don't get the promises. I'll just save it for the next generation and we'll see how they do. And God meant what He said. They died. Their children went in. They won victory after victory after victory. And they took the land. The lesson is there still for us today. Believe in God. Thank God. Trust God. Wait on God. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, you believe in the Son of God. And you believe in His power. Tonight you're willing to confess that He is the Son of God. You'll repent. You'll change your life. Whatever God wants, that's just what you want to do. Whatever He wants you to do. Tonight, just like Mahali did this morning, you'll be baptized so your sins can be washed away. Or maybe you're here and you're looking at your life and you're saying, you know, I know I'm a Christian. I know I've been baptized into Christ, but I just haven't been living that kind of faith and I need to. I want you to pray for me. You can always ask for the prayers of the people here. Won't you please come? I'll be standing soon.